Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast. This is part two of the biggest photography lessons of the year. Hey, I am your host, Raymond Hatfield, and I hope that you had a happy holiday. I know many of you may have unwrapped some new fun photo toys. Some of you maybe even unwrapped your first camera, and you're here because you are looking to learn photography. And if that is you, welcome. I actually highly encourage you, I'm very glad that you're here, but I highly encourage you to start this journey with last week's episode if you haven't heard it. That's episode 281, and that is part one of this two-part series, the biggest lessons that I've learned this year. And that's because last week we recapped episodes where you heard from four photographers, and the focus was on two main themes, and that was getting started from a technical standpoint, but also learning to listen to your photographic voice. So again, if you haven't, go back, listen to that, and then once you're done, come join the friendliest place on the internet for new photographers to ask questions and share photos. That is the Beginner Photography Podcast community on Facebook. So if you're not a part of it already, you can just search Facebook for Beginner Photography Podcast. You'll see the group. Click to join right there. Or you can just click the link on our homepage at beginnerphotographypodcast.com. The link will also be in the show notes of this episode if you're not brand new to podcasts and you know how to check out the show notes. But then when you're done with that, then go ahead and come back here, because this week we are hearing from four more photographers. But this time we're focusing on two new themes. It's the next steps, right? So first up that we got here is the theme of building yourself, building who you want to be as a photographer. So here is part of my interview with Rachel Greiman from episode 251, who talks about finding what genre of photography makes her happiest, families, but then the unique twist that she puts on it to make it her own. Let's go back to the photojournalism side. So now you're in college, mm-hmm. you're learning as much as you can about just how to document what's going around and telling a story, with your camera. Was the goal at that point to work for a newspaper, or was it to, document families? And I guess, how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah. So I loved telling stories always. I've always loved that. I've always loved writing. I have always loved interviewing people and hearing kind of their background. That's really interesting to me. And I picked photojournalism because I felt like there were jobs there. Like, I didn't want to be a fine art photography major because I was like, what do you do with that? I don't get that. But I was like, oh, I could work for a newspaper, or I could do this. And I volunteered at a lot of nonprofits throughout college, and I always photographed and told the stories of the people that we served or the people that I worked with. And then that became my career path for a long time. I worked in nonprofits after college, and I was always the writer and photographer at the various nonprofits. And that is really where my photojournalism degree got put to the best use, I think. Mm-hmm. And then, so I worked at probably four different nonprofits doing writing and photography. And then in 2014, I had people from my church actually start asking me to take pictures of their families. And I noticed that I really, really liked all the images where I wasn't posing anyone. I was really bad at posing people, and I still am. I'm really bad at it, and I'm woman enough to admit it. And my best images and the ones that the families liked the most were the ones where I wasn't asking the 2-year-old to listen to me, and I was just photographing the moments in front of me. And then I found Kirsten Lewis, who I call the godmother of documentary family photography. She basically invented the genre. And I saw a class on Creative Live that she taught, where she did like a 72-hour session with the family.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, this is what I want to do. This is it. I like done, signed. This is all I want to do for the rest of my life. And so I slowly started transitioning out of my full-time job, and I started my business, and then I started doing documentary family. And it was really all the same elements of telling stories at nonprofits and telling stories of, my subjects and assignments in college, just geared toward families.
That is incredible. I love to hear that story. And I think that a lot of the listeners are going to resonate with that a lot, mm-hmm. as well, because we all kind of get some sort of education in photography. I take that back. Some people just you know, go to Costco, buy the camera. Now, right. Where do I start? Right.
Yeah.
I understand that. But there's also a large portion of people who started, you know, maybe a few years ago. They were interested in photography. It kind of gets to this point, and now they're like, I could leave my job. Like, maybe I could do something with this. You know, and that's what you did, and you've obviously had success now, which is wonderful to hear. So, again, I know that listeners are going to really appreciate your take on that. So now that let's talk about when you did decide to do that, right? So you jumped all in. You already had the education in photojournalism. Mm-hmm. So you kind of got, I hate to say, a head start there, but when we think back to our earliest images, it's typically just like, oh, these are garbage, right? Mm-hmm. But when you already have a little bit of that education there, maybe it's not so far. So I would love to know if you had to think back to maybe that first family session that you did, right? Mm-hmm. What's something that sticks out to you as oh my gosh, I would never do that today?
Well, I mean, like, the whole thing was posed, so I would never do that now.
Yeah, okay, I see. So, hold on. Well, then why did you take that approach? What if you went through photojournalism, you knew, like, let's capture the story here, you know, let's not interfere. Why did you decide, I'm going to switch things up and just go around, I know nothing about, and pose these people?
Yeah, well, when people from my church asked me to take photos of them, they just knew that I was a photographer for a nonprofit. Like, they just knew that was my job. Mm-hmm. And I told them, I've never shot a family before in my life. Like, I've only ever done photojournalism. I did not know that documentary family photography existed then, probably for the first year of my business. So I literally probably went on Pinterest and looked at, I'm sure that I did that.
Right.
Went on Pinterest and looked at images of, like, what family photographers do, because I had no idea. And I told them, like, up front, they probably paid me $50, if they even paid me at all, for that session. And I was like, just emulating everything that I saw. Nothing felt original. But even in that session, I remember the images I shared were ones that were not posed. Mm-hmm. And because they were the only ones that I really liked. And so I even from the first sessions, I could feel a draw toward that. I just didn't know it was a thing. I didn't know that. I just assumed everybody wanted to go to a park or a field and have images of themselves and their kids on their best day in their best clothes.
Right.
And now I would never do that. I would never do any of it. But it was valuable to, it wasn't, I think that style of photography is valuable. I am just not the person to do it because I'm not good at it.
Of course, of course. And I think the listeners understand that. You know, we've talked about this many times. I fully understand that. You know, I interview pet photographers. I'm not going to photograph pets. That's not my thing. You know?
I can't even take pictures of my own dog.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I absolutely get that. So where you're at today, I would love to hear in your own words, what elements go in to one of your photographs? Like, what does it take for you to, like, put your name on this and say, this one's a keeper? Hey, Raymond here. If you're sometimes baffled by which camera settings to use, then I've got just the thing for you. My free guide, Picture Perfect Camera Settings. It's a fantastic starting point for anybody eager to understand the basics of camera settings in various shooting scenarios. And it's tailored to beginners who want to get out of auto mode, providing clear, easy-to-follow suggestions on where to start with your settings. So whether you're capturing a stunning landscape or a family portrait, Picture Perfect Camera Settings will help you to get off of automatic mode and explore the possibilities your camera offers. Remember, mastering photography settings is a journey, and this guide is your first step and the perfect resource to guide you towards finding the right settings for your style. So grab your copy today at perfectcamerasettings.com and start your journey to better photos.
That's a great question. I mean, when I spend 12 hours with a family, which is, I haven't done in over a year because of COVID. But when I have in the past, over the past few years, I'm getting hundreds of images throughout the day. I mean, I'll fill up 232 gig cards. And I don't even know if that's accurate. I haven't done it in so long.
Sounds right.
Just like hundreds of images.
Yeah.
And so, like, the first cull is usually going through and just getting rid of all the crap ones that are like not salvageable, too dark. Because if you think about it, if in a house, you're changing lighting scenarios every time you rotate.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on a wedding day too, but like usually on a wedding day, if you're outside, you can keep your settings pretty much the same. But in a house, by a window is a lot different than when you turn around to get the other kid in the dark kitchen. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of just have to be scrapped images that I was moving too quick and didn't change my settings in time. But to put my stamp of approval on an image, there usually has to be an action happening. Like it can't just be like, I have plenty of like a cute face that they're making at the camera, but it usually has to have an action of some sort. Mm-hmm. Like they have to be picking their nose or picking a wedgie or eating something or yelling. I love having at least two subjects in the frame, whether that's a pet or a dog or a toy that they're playing with. It's just so much more interesting if there's more than just a pretty photo of a kid, because I can take a pretty photo of a kid with my eyes closed. It's just so much more interesting and unique and tells such a stronger story if there's actually something happening in the image.
Mm-hmm. So how do you, what's the balance there between not wanting to create something versus just documenting what's happening?
You don't have to create something if there's kids involved. You just don't. If you're there long enough, they will show you something weird. Kirsten always says that kids are weird, and they are. They're so weird. And and if you reward the weird behavior with the click of a shutter, they'll do it seven more times. So like if they jump off of it and you giggle and take a photo, they're going to be like, she liked that. I'm going to do that again.
Sure.
And so I just am so rarely ever having to fabricate anything. And I don't like, I never ask them. At every family session, I will have them pose for a family portrait.
Sure.
But that's like 30 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the, this might be more of the customer service or the business side of things.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that sort of behavior is probably not what parents think of as good behavior for, you know, a photo shoot. So how do you kind of deal with that communication with your clients so that they understand that that's okay?
Well, people don't inquire with me unless that's what they want. And that is like total positioning in the way I talk about photography and what I show. Mm-hmm. I will never, ever show. And this is the most valuable thing I learned at the beginning of my business, was never, ever show anything that you don't want to photograph. Mm-hmm. Because what you show is the quickest way to tell people how you shoot. So if you don't want to pose people, never put a posed image on your feed or on your website or on Facebook. You don't want to draw attention to things you're not going to shoot, because that sets your customers up for disappointment and unmet expectations. So for me, when people inquire with me, my process, when I tell them what happens, I always say pajamas to pajamas. From the time your kids wake up in the morning till the time they go to bed, that's when I'm there. And I will just document everything that you do. And I always say, I will pull you guys aside in a calm moment when everybody's in a good mood to get a family portrait, but I will only do it once. Mm-hmm. So if you want more than that, I'm not the girl for you. And I typically send them a slideshow or a full gallery of somebody else's session. That way they can see kind of the lay of the land. Like, these are the images you're getting. There's going to be double chins. There's going to be kids picking their noses. You know, there's going to be gross eating pictures because it's funny. And if they want that, then great. But, you know, marketing 101, I'm not for everybody. I know that 90% of moms don't want those kinds of images, but the 10% who do are the ones that I'm here for.
Only show what you want to shoot. That right there is billing yourself. Feel free, I mean, by all means, to shoot it all, right? If somebody wants commercial photography from you and you feel up for it, take it. If you want to approach a local restaurant and ask to photograph their menu, right? The items on their menu, go for it. But that, you know, if don't show those images, those light and airy Pinterest photos, if you really just love the raw, unfinished look of black and white. Now, continuing on this theme of building yourself, up next is from my conversation with photo editor Brad Smith from episode 256. Now, a photo editor, if you're brand new, is in the publishing world, the person who chooses which photographer to use for which assignment, and then they choose the photos to use for whatever the purpose is needed for, right? Whether it's an ad, what photo are you going to use, a newspaper article, what photo are you going to use, a magazine spread, etc. Now, again, a photo editor in the publishing world is not the person who sits in front of Lightroom all day making other people's photos look better, right? So this is a snippet, or I guess in this snippet, Brad talks about being how to become the right photographer for the job. Okay, so I have a question that I'm still trying to formulate, I guess, in my head, and that is, at some point, a photographer has to enter into your ecosystem. You have to know of who they are. And is this is typically done, I'm guessing, through a portfolio. They send you a portfolio, you see a portfolio, and then from that, you put them into a bucket of where they're going to be best. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think that the number of opportunities and options that they can enter my universe has grown exponentially over the years, mm-hmm. right? It used to be whatever way. It doesn't matter what it used to be because it doesn't exist anymore. You know, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Now this is the way we do it. And the way we do it is I could find you on Instagram. I could find you by word of mouth. I could find you because you won some award. I could find you because my wife mentioned your name one day. I mean, it could be like from anywhere. I don't care where they come from. I just want to know that this is where they are. Now I found out that part. My next thing is, where do you live? That's the first question I ask is, where do you live? And once I get that, then I like dive into the work and see what kind of work you do. Is it interesting to me? Is it work I want to look? And I would always, no matter where they live, I'm going to dive into looking at their work. Mm-hmm. But if they tell me they're in Belarus, I'm less likely to use them than if they tell me they're in Florida. So those things are important. It's not like it's inconsequential where they work. I mean, where they live and work. But then I dive into what type of photography do you offer? Are you better at the action part of it? Or are you better at the feature part of it? Are you really good at portraits, but not so good at action? And we kind of break it down that way. And then I kind of set my mental Rolodex up where I realize I've got people here, here, and here. I keep a series of post-its on a map in my office. And it kind of like, this is where I've got people here. And I realize, you know, when I inherited the staff at the WWE and I looked at where the photographers lived, we had two staffers and there were about seven freelancers that they used on a regular basis. Those seven freelancers lived in three states.
Oh, wow.
All seven. Florida, Connecticut, and California. Every single one of them lived in some vicinity of those three places. There was nobody in between. And that was because it never occurred to them not to put them on a plane. So it didn't really matter where they live, right?
Yeah.
When we changed the philosophy of, I want more regional representation, then we had to really start considering, I have nobody in the Midwest. Who am I going to use in the Midwest? I have nobody in Mexico. And we go there. I have nobody in London and we go there all the time. Now we're in London all the time. I have a guy shooting for me in London that shoots constantly for me, COVID aside. He shoots constantly for me because there's no way in the world I'm going to put somebody on a plane constantly and send them over to London. That just doesn't make business sense, you know?
Yeah,
so sure. Once I get a hold of where they are, if I like their work, if I'm drawn to their work, if I feel compelled to somehow some attraction to their work, we're off and running, right? Now it's just a matter of, we have a phone conversation. Do I like you? Do I want to work with you? Am I getting along with you? If you don't fall into those categories, like any other relationship, it kind of dies pretty quickly, you know? Because at the end of the day, people want to work with people they want to work with, you know?
There are two ways to bring home more money with your photography business. You either get more clients or you spend less of the money that you make. CloudSpot Studio helps you keep more of what you earn. With the lowest payment processing fees in the industry, the average photographer will save $300 annually. And that's just more money to invest in essential gear like a new flash or a sweet camera bag. You know, one that is perfect for storing all of the wedding day snacks that you can pack. But it's not just about savings. CloudSpot Studio is designed to streamline your workflow. Easily organize shoots, send contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and you're really going to enjoy the hassle-free payments. So sign up for a free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com. And as a bonus, you're going to get access to my exclusive wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires at no additional cost. Why let fees chip away at your profits? Empower your photo journey with CloudSpot and watch your business soar. I could see how obviously all that linking together is going to make your life a whole lot easier when looking for a photographer.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the portfolio aspect of it, because I know, again, a lot of new photographers have questions about portfolios. I did when I first started, like as a wedding photographer, like, do I even need a portfolio? How does this work? So for you, what is it that is going to make a, in that example that you gave, you may talk to 8 photographers, look at 8 different portfolios, 7, not so much, but one of them is going to stand out. What is it in that 8th portfolio that you look at that makes it stand out above the rest?
Yeah. So I would say that if I'm looking at a number of books, and again, photography is as diverse as it could be, you know? So I do get asked to look at portfolios, and they're not all sports photographers. They're not all action-oriented event photographers, whatever you want to call the WWE. So some of them are just wanting to get feedback, and that's like a different conversation. That's just a general philosophical photo conversation, right? But the ones that are kind of falling into my category of, I could see working with this person for this reason or that reason. I think that what separates them is their work is, A, it's of a quality that I could use, number one. I start with that. I have a benchmark of it. It's got to be a certain quality. You have to understand that I'm primarily promotional, marketing, editorial driven photo person, right? For my company. Almost all the photos we use are used internally to promote the WWE again, right? I use the photos that we take, almost the majority of 90% of them are used just to promote it all over again. It's the same person who shoots for the circus. You know, all those photos are just used to promote the circus. You mm-hmm. know, they're used to promote the program. And they're used to sell it because they're coming to Atlanta next week. That's what the photos are for. And our company is very similar to that. So with that being the case, what I want is somebody who kind of lives within the guidelines, I guess, so to speak, or certainly the style of what we do, right? Which is not sketchy black and white. And it's not anything that's like some kind of quirky kind of processing thing. And it's not, you know, this shoot from the hip guerrilla journalism thing where it's all out of focus and really kind of like, you know, street. That's not what we do. I appreciate that stuff, but that's not what we do. I need somebody that can come in and document what we do on the parameters that we do. So the quality is there, and yet your work somehow is distinguished by being a little different than other people, right? That's the hardest thing, I think, for photographers to really get a hold of, because they are fed so many visuals from so many people that they, rightfully so, are trying so hard to kind of emulate, style themselves after, and so forth. And it all sounds good until you find your own style. And hopefully it's sooner than later that you find, this is my direction, right? And to say what it is impossible. It's like love. You just know it when it hits you, you know? You couldn't define it if you wanted to. But you can try. Everybody's been trying forever. But the reality is, you know it when you feel it, right? So
yeah,
if that makes sense. And they don't necessarily had to have shot wrestling before to shoot it. I've got a bunch of people who work for me who are more traditional sports type photographers, and they're learning the wrestling part, but they're bringing the hand-eye coordination, action type photography with them and doing a great job understanding that part of it. And they're just shooting this sporting event instead of a different sporting event, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I would imagine that I've never shot a football game or a baseball game or a wrestling event, but I would imagine that it's kind of similar in the ecosystem where you need to show like everybody's here. You need to get the action itself. We need some payoff. I understand that. But when it comes to building the portfolio, how do we recognize gaps in what we have? Does that question make sense, or is it dependent on who's viewing the portfolio?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the second part is true, because you know, you could show it to 5 people and literally get 5 different recommendations on what you should do in the portfolio. So I don't, you know, and that's because it's not math, and it's a subjective business that we're in. That's what you have to do with it. And I would recommend that every photographer, A, don't take anything personally if it's possible. B, after they've insulted you or told you this isn't any good or that's any good, just take a breath and go sit by yourself somewhere and think, what can I honestly use from this conversation, right? What will help me? You know, if four people told you some photo doesn't work, then it doesn't work. If one person out of 20 told you some photo doesn't work, 19 liked it or didn't say anything, so I wouldn't worry about it. You know, I mean, that's, I think you have to kind of take that into account as to how many people are kind of viewing it. Number two, I don't think you can have enough people look at your work, photo people specifically, professionals, that's professors, an editor at a local newspaper, if you're in college or whatever, get away from your school for a minute and go have somebody else look at it. There's tons of online portfolio reviews, and some of them cost money, some of them are free, I guess you have to just find. Plus, there's a network. Ask somebody to look at your work. What's the worst they could do? Not answer your email? That's the worst thing that happens. You know, you're not going to jail for it. Just ask them. They can say, your portfolio is your website at this point. I don't see many portfolios anymore that isn't basically going over somebody's website. I mean, that's what you have to kind of remember, is the majority of things, especially now, is your basic website. Now, as you get in different levels of photography, that changes. My wife does fine art photography. She has an actual portfolio, right? And they're like big prints, and they, you know, it's a different process. The whole thing is different. You know, I'm like, show me your 10 best photos. I'm going to decide if I like you or not, and then I'm going to have somebody else come in. I'm like, boom, boom, boom. And my wife's more like, you know, sit there and look at stuff for a while, and they talk about things and philosophy and styles and what were you going for, because a lot of it's interpretive, et cetera, et cetera. And all that's great. It's just different than what I'm doing, right? I think that the two mistakes that photographers make in the beginning, and let's be really clear, they make a lot of really great decisions, not all mistakes by any means. Make a lot of really good, smart decisions. But the two big mistakes they make, number one, they make a mistake if they think it's only about their photography. Ah. They think it's just their pictures. I'm a really good photographer. I have all this great work, and I'm going to get work. Completely wrong. Now, you might get hired once like that. But if you're not somebody they want to work with, and I'm not going to fill in the obvious blanks of what that means because it's different for everybody. But if you can't represent me, which is what you're doing when you go somewhere to shoot for me in the way that I want you to, I'm not hiring you, right? If you can't figure out how to do things and get along with people, if you're rude to somebody or you use their bathroom without asking or whatever it is, you know, seriously, these things happen.
Yeah.
And so it's foolish to think that it's only your photography that gets you work, number one. Number two, I think you have to understand that not every client wants to look at the same work. And I don't know who you're showing it to, so I can't really answer those things. But
of course,
Vanity Fair does not want to see the same thing that Newsweek wants to see. And Newsweek does not want to see the same exact thing that the Associated Press wants to see. But you have to figure out who you're showing it to. And there may be a few people that fall into that category, but you should customize it to some degree for who your audience is on the other end, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what you're allowed to do on your website. I also think that you are primarily, and this is a cliche, but I think you have to kind of consider the boundaries of it. You're somewhat as good as your weakest link, you know? And if you show me 20 photos, if you show 20 photos and like three of them are like, what the hell is this doing in there? Now I start to question, right? You know, I mean, if you picture it like a date and the date went pretty good and, you know, and she did this or he did that or whatever, and it seemed nice and they were smart and they were funny and they showed up on time and we're getting along. And then out of nowhere, at the end of the night, the valet parking guy comes and he brings you the wrong car and you start cursing at what an idiot is. You're like, hey, what's going on here? First of all, I'm sorry, that's not my car. Oh, that's so funny. Like, there's two different ways to handle things, right? Yes. And you realize red flag, and run away. And that's the same thing with your photo portfolio or your website. If there's like a button, I'm thinking, wait, which person am I getting here? The person that chose these images or the person that thinks this is a good picture? This is not a good picture. And I get that sometimes, you know, your portfolio kind of morphs and stuff, but you want it to be strong. I can't overemphasize, there's no point in a higher number of images if they're not all great in your portfolio. You just want to show this, and nobody thinks this is all you do and you won't make mistakes. They're not stupid, but they only want to see the best stuff. This is what I potentially could do for you. That's what your portfolio is saying to somebody. If you hire me, I could do this kind of work.
As you can tell, image selection is hugely very important when showing off your work. So take the time to put it together. Take the time to get feedback on those images and take the time to consider who will be looking at your portfolio, and you'll be in great shape. Shifting gears here, so far from this week's interview and last, we've tackled the themes of getting started, finding your voice in photography, building yourself into the photographer that you want to be, and now the next level, finding what is next for you. So first, we are talking with Anna Harvingston from episode 255. Anna was actually on the Hulu photography competition show Exposed. Now, if you haven't seen the show, the premise is that you can take a great photo no matter what gear you're using, even if it's just a cell phone. So every photo from the contestants was taken on a cell phone, which I think is so cool because cell phone tech is obviously just keeps getting better and better and better. But here, Anna talks about using her knowledge as a traditional photographer and applying it to this new this new technology. What I'm interested to know, like, because oftentimes, you know, especially with new photographers, you spend the money on this, you know, this nice camera, you get it. Sometimes, obviously, it's going to be larger than a phone. And at points, you do have to make that decision of, like, well, when do I choose the phone to take a photo and when do I choose the DSLR here? So do you have like a yes, no type answer for when you would use either or?
I mean, I would never take, I don't think I would ever shoot anything that I did for like a client, or not that I really run like a business, but like if I'm like, you know, taking photos for friends or something, I would never just take my phone and whip that up, be like, here we go, let's get started. But I do like to incorporate shooting on my phone into those sessions. There's a lot of fun things that you can do. You can take short video clips that you can turn into GIFs or GIFs. I don't know how to say that. So we're just either one.
Everybody's very split on that. So
yeah, like I don't really know how to say it. So we're just, you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, just like having like different lenses available on the phone, the ultra wides, the telephoto, different effects that you can get easily on the phone. Like it's just fun. A lot of people want to print their stuff, but a lot of people are just interested in sharing it online. And so like to have those fun little moments, I'm not worried about it being shot on the biggest sensor possible. I'm just worried that we captured the emotion and the fun. And so anything outside of that, it's going to weigh depending, you know, what are we doing that day? Where are we going? The past couple of trips, obviously it's been a little while since we went on like a trip, but like my husband and I try to go somewhere once a year for a week or so. And I am usually very intentional about only bringing my phone because, you know, we're there to enjoy ourselves. And the point of the trip isn't for me to bring my camera and set aside all this time. But at the same time, I still want to document as we go. We went to Boston a couple of years ago and it was a busy weekend. We were there for a wedding. That was actually probably the first time I said, like, I'm not bringing my camera. And I just shot the whole weekend on my phone. And then we had like a 2-hour plane ride back home. And it was so cool because by the time I got off the plane, I had culled all my images, edited everything. Like the whole trip was like edited. And I was like home and I was like, wow, this is like so cool. And I could just share the images like whenever I wanted to. So I think it's kind of embracing, you know, I could have very well brought my camera and I could have turned out the same images or better images. You know, I don't know. But the point was that I wasn't worried about turning out like professional level images from that. So I brought my phone. And like on that note, you know, I think it is getting harder and harder. If you know what you're doing as a photographer, it's getting harder to decipher what was shot on what. And I'll refer back to the show. And, you know, there's been naysayers that are like, oh, well, this whole show was shot on phones. It's garbage. But if I'd showed you the images that we created before I told you that we shot them on phones, mm-hmm. would you have known that we shot them on phones? Because I'm gonna wager that your guess is probably no, you wouldn't have had any idea.
You know, I was born in 88, so it's like growing up, I didn't even have like a cell phone in high school until like I was a senior.
Yeah, me
you
either.
Know, and now it's like, but now the 20-year-olds or whatever have had phones their whole life, and I feel like I can look at them and they're just, I mean, obviously not as a whole, this isn't a blanket statement, but there's more creativity, like freely, like maybe it's easier to be creative, like when
tools are more accessible, so right. You know, yeah.
So you know, as you were saying that, thank you for trying to for putting together my long convoluted idea into much simpler terms there. And I feel like I would probably also feel pressured to maybe just throw like a Hail Mary pass and do something that maybe I wasn't, that wasn't within my zone of genius in terms of photography. Did you feel like that at all? Or you found it pretty easy to stay true to your style?
Yeah, I did. I was able to really stay true to my style. I think for that first episode, you know, it's like they throw that flash on at you. This is so brand new. There's cameras everywhere. Like, you're just like, I was like petrified. I'm sure if you watch it, you'll be like, oh, wow, she's terrified. And so I think I was trying to be very like literal at first, like with the challenge that we had. And it wasn't that what I created was bad. It just didn't stand out in any way. So I very quickly figured out like, okay, I need to stay true to what I know, because what I don't have time to do is try something completely different. I don't have time to emulate somebody else. But I also have to throw creativity in there. So how can I do that? How can I bring over these skills that I'm good at, that I know I'm good at? And then what can I add? So it's kind of like playing it safe in the risky zone. You know, it's like, I've got to be risky enough to stand out, but I also cannot deviate so far from myself that, you know, like, I'm very comfortable. I edit in Lightroom, and I would never like put it on myself to create something perfectly in camera that I'm like, I'm not going to touch this later. Like, I'm not, I don't do Photoshop and stuff. Like, that's not really in my, like, my area of expertise, you know, but it's like, I shoot knowing that I can like alter colors a little bit. I can, you know, like dodge and burn, and like, I can do these tweaks that are going to bring this to life. So how do I take a photo, know that I can use those skills, and then what can I add? Like, what's the extra layer? What's the icing on the cake that I can throw on that I'm comfortable doing that is going to make me stand out in this competition?
Do you have an example of what that icing on the cake was? Are we talking editing, or are we talking tricks in camera?
I think it just depended. It depends on each challenge. So like, to talk about the first portfolio challenge, we had to self-portraiture, which we were all terrified of. And then we had to recreate a historical painting. And so for me in that moment, my thought process is, okay, what literal elements, you know, going back to the flash challenge in the episode where we had to, it was a throwback Thursday challenge. We had to recreate a childhood photo of ourselves. And I very literally brought elements over, tried to lay things out, you know, exactly the same as they were in the photo. For that later one, I did want to bring over elements from that photo specifically, you know, hey, this color, this hairstyle, this same composition and pose, those are things that I wanted to bring over. And then the twist that I wanted to add was a play on the name of the painting, which the name of the painting is A Portrait of a Young Woman. And so what I did was, and especially since this was like a cell phone related show, was I borrowed a phone from another contestant and took a selfie of myself. So I'm like in the same pose with the same lighting. So I lined all these elements up and then added that as a twist, that like, hey, here's a modern version of that. And it took me, like, I had to think on it for a couple minutes to think, like, what can I do to make this different? What can I do? And I think there's various elements. I could have made it humorous. I could have done a couple things. But in the end, that I was like, I feel like this is enough to make this stand out, but not so risky that they're going to be like, hey, you didn't quite hit the mark here. There was enough literal elements that I brought over to stay safe. So
that was a fantastic example. That is so great. You know, I try to put myself in that situation, like trying to think, and I would 100% be the person to try to go so overboard that that I would just fall flat on my face. So
yeah,
I'm glad that that worked out for you. Do you think that your photography is going to change or evolve going forward now that the show's over?
Yeah, I think in ways it will. I think knowing that I can always go back to those skills that I've acquired, you know, as my photography changed through the years, as my kids grew up, you know, got older, I very much took on a much more documentary approach. You know, we have our times we go into portraits and things like that, but overall, I would say if I had to pick like two genres that I really do a lot, it's documentary and it's landscapes and nature. And it's those, because documentary is based around my family. You know, if we go to the park, I'm not asking my kids to look and smile at the camera. I'm just going to find a fun, creative way to document that experience that brings it to life for the viewer that they can connect with, you know, a fun angle or a burst of light, something that really draws them in to what is like an ordinary moment. And then landscapes and nature, because I have 5 kids and sometimes I need to just get out and have some time for me. And so that's very much what that is. But I think moving forward, being able to take those elements and things that I've learned shooting those two genres specifically and then use them to capture other things, whether it's branding and working with businesses using a photojournalistic, you know, documentary approach, or whether it's shooting people, but thinking of like setting up a scene similar to how you would want something to be pretty like in nature, you know? So I think it's kind of like, it's, like I said, it's ongoing, and I want to bring elements of who I am and where I come from, what my story is, and then continue to explore like new things with that.
What I love is that even though Anna is an accomplished photographer and she has proven her abilities with a cell phone, she still looks ahead and seeing ways that she can continue to grow as an image maker. You really have to trust yourself. That is so cool. Now, we have had an incredible lineup so far of amazing photographers, but I want to leave you with my biggest takeaway of the year, which came from We Win in episode 257. Now, We is one of the founders of Fearless Photography, a blog, a selection of photographers who truly are fearless in what it is that they do, in the way that they capture their work. Now, he's been shooting, I mean, decades worth of experience. So he is a man to talk to about this, and I'm really excited about what he shares. Here he starts out with the progression of simple mistakes that beginners make in their images, and then how it progresses to get to the point to where you become just fearless in your photography. Because I know that you've hosted, you know, many workshops with other photographers, often new photographers, photographers who want to capture those more emotion-driven moments. Where do you think their struggles are? Like, when you look at their images and try to help them get to where you are, what do you think that they're missing in their photography?
In general, I think many photographers who photograph weddings are still very much, you know, with the mindset that weddings are about beautiful people in beautiful places. Mm-hmm. And somehow that sort of colors everything they do. So they just need to put that aside. So they need to, I guess, so that's the whole thing about fearless, right? Fearless is about putting things aside and committing yourself to doing something and not worry about not getting enough beauty photos, because that time will come and you will please your clients. If, you know, if your clients are in tune with what you do, if your clients want to, so the hardest thing is not committing to it. I think it's not committing to it, and it letting them let sort of holding themselves back. People are holding themselves back because they make up reasons. And I don't want to say everyone does this, but I think that's why I see it's like when we don't want to do something, again, we say the client doesn't want that. You know, the client doesn't want that photo. I don't want it, or I can't do it, or I don't have to, whatever. We rationalize what we don't want to do. Mm-hmm. So when people are not committed 100%, then they're very good at rationalizing and coming up with reasons why they don't, why they can't commit to it.
So a lot of it is you think that a lot of it is perhaps mental block rather than education or inspiration? Does that make sense?
A lot of it, there's equal parts on everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why photography is so interesting, right? It's not just learning how to use the camera. I'm just now we are talking about sort of more advanced, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. At first, and I want to use another analogy on you, right? So I have a lot of these. When you play tennis, you know, when you learn how to play tennis, at first, all you're learning is just to hit the ball across the net, mm-hmm. without going out of bounds, right? You just want to run to the ball and hit a forehand or a backhand, put the ball back in play, That's all you're doing. So that's the, in the beginning, you want to get good at that. So meaning that in photography, in the beginning, you just want to make good photos. You just want to make good photos of things you want to shoot. You want to make clear, sharp, good light photos, photos that shows what you want to show. And then once you get good at this, you begin to play competitively. And now you begin to spin the ball. You begin to place the ball. You're beginning to understand your opponent's weaknesses and strengths, and you're beginning to play the game. So now you start to think more about what you want to do with all your skills that you have. So at the beginning, you're just making good pictures, right? So if I have a crew of photographers, right? If I have crew of photographers and we cover the wedding, and I have one photographer dedicated to photographing the ceremony, and I keep that photographer focused, and their job is to photograph the ceremony with me, and they don't have to worry about beauty photos, they don't have to worry about the dancing photos, they don't have to worry about details. Their job is to focus on this thing. I think that if you have that mindset, that photographer will probably do a pretty good job,
yeah,
because they don't have to worry about all these things, right? They don't have to be fearless. They're like, hey, that's not my problem. My job right now, we told me, is to photograph this ceremony, right? And they don't have any fears about anything else happening in the wedding. So if we all have that mindset, if we can, go to a wedding and focus on what we're doing at one time and not worried or not be concerned about what we're doing at other times. I'm not saying be oblivious, but I'm saying focus on what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. This is a fun conversation. I'll tell you what.
Oh, it's good. I'm glad.
Very rarely, I guess, I hate to say very rarely am I challenged because that sounds ridiculous, but I guess very rarely is my take on wedding photography put into, like, now I'm questioning a lot of the decisions that I make at weddings, because I know that there's, you know, unfortunately, like, I'll admit that there have been weddings where I've just had to phone it in, where it just seemed like nothing was working, and, you know, I just, again, I could come up with a million excuses, but talking with you, I love this, like, nope, that's my fault. This is 100% my fault. And that I need to do better. And just like your website, you know, just with seeing all of the other photographers there inspires me to take better photos. This conversation has inspired me to take more ownership over the bad photos that I take. So I appreciate that. Have you ever had a situation where you've been too fearless in a photo that you took, where it just totally fell flat on its face? You tried something big and it did not work.
I think we do. Yes. I mean, definitely things don't work all the time, right? And that's the thing about making mistakes. We can't guarantee our successes. Sometimes, you know, you just, you know, right? Things don't, you have to try, right? So, yeah. So I say that's the many shots that didn't come out as well as I wanted to. Many times when I've misread situations, maybe, you know, I've been too close or something, or maybe I didn't understand something, or maybe I didn't have the trust that I needed with everyone. So sometimes I'm not as effective as I wanted to be. Yeah. So what do we do, you know, when something like that happens? We have to be, what do you do, again, athletes, what do they do when they don't succeed? They make a bad play or something.
Try again.
I think they learn to put it aside, right? Mm-hmm. They've learned to, you know, to make a blunder or something. They're like, even the toughest, you know, like the kicker who missed that kick, right? And then the game goes overtime and he's got to make that kick again, right? So it's like, how much that weighing on him, right? So hopefully professional athletes are trained to treat everything as a new beginning or whatever. They put it, put it aside, right? So yeah. So but yeah, have to try. And you have to try, and if it doesn't work, maybe there's a time you can evaluate later. Like maybe after the wedding, you start thinking back about, okay, you know what? When I think back, maybe this is a good time to learn, good time to assess how I'm doing things. Okay. You know, yeah, maybe I can reassess, but you got to go into a wedding and you have to know that at least 5 things are going to go wrong. And when they go wrong, yeah, you just check out the list. You're like, hey, that's number one. That's number two. That's number three. So you're not surprised. You're not like, oh my God, oh no, I thought I have a perfect wedding today. You don't. You never do. So you're like, hey, you know, so 5 people are going to yell at you, right? 5 people are going to say, get out of here. I don't want you here. Okay, fine. You know? But if you get 10, then maybe that's the problem. Maybe you should you should wear better deodorant, you know? Okay. You know, but you got to know that a certain number of things going to happen. Certain number of mistakes going to be made. Certain number of successes going to be made. Certain number of mistakes going to be made. You're going to win a lot. You're going to lose a lot. In the end, your clients will always be happy because you can always deliver, right? Because our clients are pretty easy to please. Our clients are, you know, even on our lowest day, I want to say, even on our toughest day, things are going wrong. We can still make pictures that are pretty good, that are good professional wedding photography that our clients can be happy with. So we're not going to ever dip below that. You know, we're always going to have a, like you and all your interviews, you know, even on your worst days, you're going to have a pretty decent interview. It's going to be okay. Not going to have the great interview sometimes, but your minimum is pretty good. And so.
Well, I'm happy to say that this is not going to be one of those interviews. This is definitely going to be one of the most memorable ones. This is going to be one where I know I'm gonna have to go back and listen to this before every wedding, just as an audio kick in the butt that I need to own up to everything that I'm gonna do on a wedding.
Exactly, that's remember. The kick in the butt is the challenge is where the fun is, right? If you go to a wedding and you're not being challenged, that's no fun. That I mean, make money, great, but it's not that fun. You know, it's fun. It's fun when things are thrown at you. It may not seem like fun, but that's why we make the big bucks, right? That's why wedding photographers are paid so much. It's when these things are thrown at us and we can handle them and we can overcome them. Let's say that Uncle Bob can't, right? But we can because we have tools, we have flashes, we have assistants, we have skills, we have experience that we can draw on to overcome situations. And that's why we're the pros and that's why we get paid a lot is for our ability to deal with these things when they happen. Hopefully it don't happen a lot, but when it comes, we're the pros, and that makes each day, each wedding very tiring, but also very satisfying, very fun. Not a boring job at all, right?
You have to know that you will never have a perfect session. You'll have some that go really good, but you will never have a perfect session. You will never have a perfect photo. But keep doing your best, of course, to achieve it because, you know, you got to know that things will go wrong. You have to know that things will go wrong. So when they do, just check them off the list, like you said, and then reset and then keep going. I know I'm going to share a story with you. One of my first, like, actually paid sessions was a family session for it was a coworker of my wife. It was mom, dad, and then I believe she was four-year-old daughter. And they just wanted, it was a holiday time, they wanted just a nice holiday photo that they could share with family and friends and whatnot. And while I was very comfortable with, you know, camera settings, I was brand new to working with clients. So I asked them what they wanted. They said that they wanted, you know, some outdoor photos looking nice, holiday photos. So I was like, okay, great. So they show up again for an outdoor session. It's 15 degrees outside. It's frigid, super cold. So, of course, they're bundled up like crazy. And the daughter has the most active runny nose I've ever seen in my life, which, of course, you know, the cold weather just it just made it worse. And the images after the fact, from a technical standpoint, I'd say were very good, if I do say so myself. But they were not the photos that you would send to family and friends for the holidays, you know, with everyone with cold faces, you know, super red, puffy jackets to stay warm. But I thought surely they can, you know, they would see how well exposed the photos were, right? No. They rightfully hated the photos. And when I got that email back, I mean, I was gutted. I felt terrible. Now, it would have been so easy for me to just give up at that point. So easy. But I knew personally that, you know, they didn't hate the photos, I guess, from a technical standpoint. That's not what they said that they hated. They hated how they looked. They hated how they were portrayed. And if I'm being honest, that was my fault, because I came at it with the mindset of, well, as long as everything's properly exposed and, you know, there's some good light, we'll be good. That's all that matters. And that's my fault, because people aren't naturally very comfortable in front of the camera. And that's my job as a photographer to help them feel comfortable and look natural in front of the camera. But what's great about that is that that's also something that I can fix going forward with knowing things like just some basic posing. And also the reason why I now bring hand warmers to every session, just to make people more comfortable in front of the camera. That's it. Do, learn, grow, repeat. Do, learn, grow, repeat. That's it for the year. Oh my gosh. Until next year. Stay warm, stay safe, keep shooting.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.